From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. What do a Super Bowl quarterback, the pilot of a 737, a Navy commander, and a poker player all have in common? They each have to make choices under stressful conditions. And how we make our choices in life is the subject of two new books. One is called How We Decide, and it takes us inside the human brain to show us the ongoing interplay between reason and emotion. The other is called Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. A conversation with authors Jonah Lehrer and Zachary Shore about decision-making and what we can all learn from our mistakes and those of others. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. I was flying a Boeing 737 when the left engine caught on fire. Then the plane began a steep bank. The evening sky turned sideways. I struggled to steer the plane straight, but couldn't. The plane was impossible to fly. You might think that that was the captain of the U.S. air flight talking about what happened last week in New York. But it's actually an excerpt from the beginning of a new book by Jonah Lehrer about how we make decisions, from pilots under stress to policymakers. How we make smart choices and avoid mistakes is also the theme of another new book by Zachary Shore called Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. In this hour forum, we take up what goes on inside our heads when we make decisions large and small, from what jam to buy in the grocery store to whether or not to go to war. Zachary Shore is an associate professor of national security affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey and a senior fellow at the University of California, Berkeley's Institute of European Studies. His book, again, Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. Zachary Shore, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Jonah Lehrer writes for The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and The Scientific American. He's the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and his new book is called How We Decide. He joins us this morning from Boston. Jonah Lehrer, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's begin, Jonah Lehrer, with the way in which you begin your book and the at least comparison that I instantly made to what Captain Sullenberger did in New York last week, because it's about that sort of thin line, as you call it, between doing just the right thing and not. If you can imagine, if you've thought about, and I'm sure you have, what was going through Captain Sullenberger's mind when he was making those series of decisions, what can we glean from that that's important for us to understand about how we make decisions?
Well, the first thing to note is that I wasn't actually flying a 737 over Tokyo. I was in a flight simulator, and I think that's an important part about what allowed Captain Sullenberger to make the right decision, is that pilots practice for these extreme situations. They practice making stressful situations in these incredibly realistic flight simulators. And I think that's an important part of what allowed Captain Sullenberger to take a deep breath and not let his fear turn into panic.
And go ahead. What is it that was in the balance there? Because you write a lot about it's thinking and not panicking, but there's also emotion, and that you really can't necessarily always say, okay, I'm only going to use my reason at this moment of high stress.
Yeah, I think the important thing to kind of note off the bat is that it's not that Captain Sullenberger wasn't terrified. Brain scanning studies show that everyone feels this baseline of emotion. I can guarantee that everyone on that plane was terrified and scared. The pilots perhaps more so because they knew just how dire their situation was. They knew they wouldn't be able to make it to New Jersey. And yet at that moment, pilots train to actually be able to exercise, you know, their rational brain, the prefrontal cortex, which allows them to kind of tamp down their emotions and think through the fear. And I think one of the larger themes of my book is that we do have these two very distinct ways of thinking. We've got this emotional brain centered in places like the amygdala, the insula, the nucleus accumbens, and we've got this rational brain, this Promethean part of the brain centered in the prefrontal cortex. And I think for too long, we've pretended that there's some universal solution to decision-making. There's some way of thinking that will allow you to make the right decision in every context. I think what pilots have learned, and I think what we all should learn, is that how you think should depend on the task at hand, and we need to tailor our thought process to the kind of decision we're making.
Jonah Lehrer, his new book is called How We Decide. Zachary Shore joins us as well. His book is called Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. Part of what Jonah Lehrer is saying, Zachary Shore, is that if not practice, make perfect. Practice counts, that you have to be able to draw upon a lengthy experience, which means, in a sense, drawing upon history. And that's part of what you write about in your book as well, that we need to draw upon the mistakes that we've made in the past in order to not make them in the future.
That's right. Well, first, maybe, Dave, it would help if I laid out some of the key differences, I think, in these two books. I read the beginning of Jonah's book last night, and it's terrific. It reads really, you write extremely well, Jonah. And
thank you.
Well, both these books are trying to understand how we think, but they're tackling two very different aspects of the problem. What Jonah does, I believe, is to focus on rapid cognition, those times when we have to make decisions in the blink of an eye, when the quarterback is in the pocket and the seconds are ticking away on the game, and you're under pressure and you've got to figure out in the pilot situation what to do in a crisis. How do you make that rapid decision? In contrast, I'm focused more on slow cognition. How do we make decisions over weeks, months, or even years? And why is it that individuals, businesses, organizations, and sometimes even whole nations will study a problem for a long period of time and still end up going horribly wrong? That's what I use history for, rather than neuroscience, to look at what were the many factors people were facing in those situations and what led them astray.
Well, let's talk then first about that question of time, Jonah Lehrer, because you write about there are times when you really should take a lot of time to make a choice, to sort of review what all of the options are, and times where you really shouldn't, that you just ought to leap in. How do you view that aspect of this process of making choices?
I think it's a long tradition. This goes all the way back to Plato and the ancient Greeks. And the assumption was that the best way to make any decision was to be rational, was to, you know, take in as much information as possible, carefully sift through it, rely on statistics, logic, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what neuroscience has found is that that's not only very unrealistic, but that's not even always the optimal way to think. And I think one of the things that surprised me while researching the book was that the latest research suggests that it's the very complex decisions, it's the really hard calls, the ones that involve lots and lots of information and variables that actually benefit from a more emotional thought process, that benefit from the processing powers of the unconscious brain. The truth of the matter is that the brain is taking in, is always taking in far more information than we're actually aware of. And that all takes place in the unconscious. And the unconscious generates these emotions, these subtle visceral feelings, telling a quarterback where to throw the ball or telling a poker player how to play their hand. And it's those signals that we should rely on in very complex decisions.
And does that apply to public policy decisions as well? Are you suggesting, Jonah Lehrer, that in a complex public policy realm that we should trust our instincts more? I'm curious about that because we've just come out of an administration where that whole business of sort of trusting your instincts and having certain surety about my gut perhaps led us in some instances rather astray.
Yeah, and it's certainly tough, as I said before, to come up with a universal prescription. I think the important thing to note is that there is no universal solution to the problem of decision making. I think one of the things that makes me hopeful about the Obama administration is I think one of the things that really characterizes Barack Obama as a thinker, at least based on reports, is his reliance on something called metacognition, which is he's very self-aware. He's always introspecting. He's thinking about how he thinks, which is what makes metacognition. And I think that's an important and crucial element of good decision making, is thinking about how you're thinking, being aware of biases and past mistakes, whether they're in history or in your own life, and using that self-awareness to actually tailor your thought process to the task at hand.
And Zachary Shore, that's a principal theme in your book as well, which is to Be aware of different options. Don't get locked in to a particularly rigid ideology.
That's exactly right. Most of the blunders I look at in history and in contemporary politics came from these rigid mindsets, rigid ways of approaching and solving problems. And you can see distinct patterns. I categorize them and label them and try to give us some labels to hold on to so that we won't be likely to fall into those same kinds of traps again, things like exposure anxiety, when people fear that they'll be seen as weak or flawed, or cause fusion, where they get confused about the causes of complex events, and a whole list of cognition traps. If we could be more cognizant, more conscious of those kinds of rigid mindsets, we'd be a lot more likely to make wiser decisions.
Well, one of the examples you cite goes back to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon several years ago, and you refer to that as one of these situations where you're perhaps Prime Minister Olmert was fearful of being exposed as being weak, and so they rushed ahead with that particular judgment. Walk us through what you think was going on there and why that or how that was an example of the kind of blunders that you describe.
I try to show many examples of this, of statesmen fearing being exposed as weak or flawed, and then the key here is that they tend to respond with excessive force, when more moderate force or diplomacy would be wiser. I think we see that repeatedly with Israel in the Middle East. You have to think about how to approach an enemy. There are always two sides. You can attack the capabilities or you can attack the intentions. And Israel is extremely good at destroying or weakening the capabilities of an adversary, but in the process, they tend to heighten the intentions of the enemy. And this is one of the many themes of blunder. People behave because of these cognition traps in ways that are counterproductive, and they end up undermining themselves.
And that comes in part from being locked in to a particular worldview that you believe in. It reminds me, a general error, of something Bill Clinton once said about the problem of having a rigid ideology is that you know the answers before you know the facts. And you also cite an Israeli example in your book, which was the refusal of the Israelis to believe that an attack was imminent prior to the Yom Kippur War. Walk us through that part of it, because it seems to me the sort of same situation, right? It was sort of believing in something without necessarily paying attention to the facts.
Yes. In that case, the Mossad and the Israeli intelligence services had something they literally called the concept, which assumed that the Arab countries wouldn't attack until they had equal parity in fighter jets. And so they didn't expect an attack until probably around 1975, this in the fall of 1973. And so they were completely unprepared for surprise invasion. And in retrospect, you can see all these signals they ignored, the massing of tanks on the border, the evacuation of Soviet personnel. The list goes on and on. In retrospect, it seems completely obvious that the Arab nations were planning an attack. And yet the Israeli intelligence services, because they had this rigid ideology, refused to accept that information. And I think one of the things you look at when you look at the brain is that the brain is very, very, very bad at accepting dissonant information. So information that conflicts with our worldview, we naturally tend to exclude. This is why conservatives watch Fox News and liberals watch MSNBC. It's just a basic principle of cognition. We filter the world to fit our ideology. And I think this can often have devastating consequences when it comes to things like international affairs.
And you cite lots of examples of precisely that phenomenon, Zachary Shore, in your book about the way we sort of screen out views that challenge our preordained ideology.
I do. Dogma is one of the main problems that leads to blunders. But what I also do is I contrast people who fell into these dogmatic, rigid mindsets with people in comparable circumstances who didn't, who avoided those cognition traps didn't blunder. Well, for example, I contrast Thailand and Vietnam in the early 1900s. In the 19th century. And they are both facing potential colonization. And the Vietnamese, under the Nguyen dynasty, they want to avoid all kinds of information about the Europeans. The Siamese, under King Mongkut and later his son, Chulalongkorn, Longhorn, they decide we're going to learn everything we can about the Europeans. We're going to study their science. We're going to study their culture. And then they're able to use that information to their advantage, and it helps them to avoid being colonized. And so there's an example of people who were open to information and willing not just to watch Fox News or the other side, but to be open to all the information coming into them, even when it disagreed with what they actually believed. So it took some special individuals and a cognizance of the potential pitfall.
Zachary Shore, his book is called Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. And you get at that same problem in a way also, Jonah Lehrer, when you talk about the team of rivals concept made famous now by Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about what Abraham Lincoln did. Is that at the heart of what you how you think we need to sort of train our brains? You said that we'd like to reject anything that's dissonant. Is the Lincoln example a sort of model for how we ought to sort of have our brains take place?
That's certainly a model, and I think you see Obama trying to emulate a similar thing in his cabinet, the importance of forcing yourself to acknowledge opposing points of view. As unpleasant as that may be, and you can see certain brain areas light up which don't generate pleasant emotions when we're confronted with unpleasant facts, I think it's very important to force yourself to be aware that you have this innate bias kind of compelling you to ignore dissonant information and to realize this bias exists and to try to get past it. One of the studies I talk about in my book was done by Philip Tetlock, a psychologist at UC Berkeley, and he followed political pundits over a series of 15 years and had them make predictions about world events, such as would Quebec secede from Canada, would George Bush be reelected, et cetera, et cetera. And what he found was that, on average, political pundits, the people we see on CNN, those talking heads on cable news, made very, very bad predictions. In fact, they tended to perform worse than random chance. So a monkey throwing darts at a board would have beaten most of these professional pundits. And the big problem Tedlick identified was this obsession with ideology, was this rigid belief system that then allowed these experts to kind of warp the facts to fit their worldview. And that proved to be a very, very dangerous thing.
And one way in which you explore that, General Lehrer, in your book is the famous taste test. And I want to talk about that a little bit, both in terms of the literal taste test, but how that example might be applied more broadly. You describe, for example, certain wine taste tests. Walk us through what that tells us about the way in which the brain takes in information.
Well, this was a study. It was a brain scanning study done by scientists at Caltech. And they had people sip a variety of wines in a brain scanner. So they're sipping the wines through plastic tubes. Not ideal conditions, but close enough. And they gave people a variety of wines. They gave people a $5 wine, a $45 wine, and a $90 bottle of wine. But sometimes they were a bit dishonest about the label. So they actually gave people the $5 bottle of wine, but told them it was $90, and on like that. What they found, of course, was that people tended to prefer the most expensive wine. So even if you gave somebody a really cheap wine, but told them it was really expensive, people tend to give that a higher rating. Sure enough, you could actually see the pleasure areas of the brain areas like the orbital frontal cortex, lighted up more. They were more active when people were sipping these expensive wines, even if the expensive wines were actually two-buck chuck they got at Trader Joe's. The most interesting part of the experiment to me, I mean, you know, in a sense, it shows that you do get what you pay for, and it explains how that operates on the level of your brain. And the quickest way to make wine more enjoyable is to charge more money for it. So in that sense, it exposes just how gullible our brain is. But I think one of the lessons I took away from this is that the wine people enjoyed most when they tasted the wines completely blindly, so with no price information at all, was the cheap wine, was the $5 bottle of Cabernet from Central Valley, California. So that suggests that in a sense, you know, it's important for us to test ourselves, to do a little self-experimentation, to occasionally conduct our own blind tests and make sure we're not just enjoying the expensive wine because it's expensive.
And the way I'm curious about this, how this might apply to policy matters, Zachary Shore, is whether or not you could do the equivalent, in other words, a sort of blind policy test. Occurs to me, for example, right now with the confirmation hearings over Timothy Geithner to be Secretary of the Treasury. If this were a Republican in the George W. Bush era and a Republican nominee for Secretary of Treasury was found to be someone who hadn't paid their taxes, you know the Democrats would be up in arms. So it seems to me in a way that we make our pronouncements about these matters because of the labels. In this case, it's not a wine label, it's a party label. So would we be better off? Would we make fewer blunders if we somehow could blind ourselves to those sorts of affiliations?
No, I don't think that's the answer, to be honest. I think it's a dangerous thing to try to map or apply too much of the findings of neuroscience into the policy realm. I think there's some value it can give us, but really, what we need to do is think about how people behave under longer time spans with a lot more variables coming at them. So a brain scan can tell us a little bit of how they're responding at that moment. But usually when people are talking about policy, they have a lot more time to think about things, and they're getting all kinds of information, and they're doing it under many different contexts over time. So maybe they're having pressure from the boss at work, the spouse and the kids are sick. There could be all kinds of things going on in people's lives. And what historians try to do is take into account all of those different contexts and all the different information coming at people and seeing how they decide. And so when we do that, we find that, yes, the dogmas lead them astray and the labels can harm them. But it's a lot more complicated than just what a brain scan might tell you.
I guess what I'm curious about, General Lehrer, in this regard is would that from what you have studied, help us make better decisions, help us open, be more open to the sort of team of rivals concept if we were less predictive in our thinking based on the label to which a particular point of view was applied?
I think the response of a typical neuroscientist to that question would be that it's very tough for humans to escape labels, that it's very tough for us not to parse the world automatically into categories.
Yeah.
So perhaps it's an ideal. I don't know. But it's certainly a very unrealistic ideal.
And is the brain itself a team of rivals, Joan Allaire? Is there a sort of war going on between reason and emotion?
I think what you see when you look at the brain when it's making lots of complex decisions is that it's literally engaged in a cortical argument. You have these different brain areas that come to different conclusions about what we should do. So at any given moment, there's this kind of blooming, buzzing confusion inside your mind with some brain areas telling you to, you know, choose the Honey Nut Cheerios and other brain areas telling you to choose the Apple Cinnamon Cheerios. And this is certainly the case when we're dealing with very complex public policy decisions. So I think one of the important things in terms of avoiding ideology is when we get stuck on on some rigid doctrine, what we do is we impose a settlement. We try to settle this argument from the top down, and that's where things get dangerous. We start biasing ourselves and start ignoring relevant information.
Joan Allaire, his book is called How We Decide. We're joined this hour as well by Zachary Shore, whose book is called Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. One of the blunders that you describe in your book, Zachary Shore, that relates to some of what we're discussing now is that we tend to it's, again, this question of sort of wanting to avoid dissonant points of view. And we want to assume that people are like us. So we, whether that's in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever, we focus in on behavior, presuming that people are going to respond just like the way we respond.
Yeah, we call it mirror imaging. Lots of fields talk about this. It's how we think that the other side will think and act like us. We have countless examples every day, right? We see it in history. We see it on the battlefield when one side, like the French at Dien Bien Phu, for example, thought that the Vietnamese would think and act the way they did. And it ended up causing a debacle for the French and the end of French predominance there in Vietnam. But we see it in all kinds of realms, like in interpersonal relationships. We tend to think that the husband or wife or our friends will think and act the way we do, and so we project onto them our ideals. So in a way, yes, we absolutely do get caught stuck in categories. But one of the things we also see is how people rise above those categories and they're able to see nuance. In all of the cases of blunders that I look at, I also find people who were able to see beyond those categories. So something must have been happening inside them that's different from what happened to others. And one of those things is a lot more empathy. The people who exhibited greater empathy were able to put themselves in the other person's mind and heart, think what they were thinking and feeling, and then come up with better decisions.
We'll talk more about how to come up with better decisions, both in everyday life as well as policy matters, when we come back. Our guests, Zachary Shore, his book Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions, and Joan Allaire, the author of How We Decide. If you have questions for our authors, questions about how to make good decisions, you can join us now. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, how we make decisions. What goes on inside our brains? How can we avoid mistakes? Why do sometimes very smart people make very bad choices? Two authors writing about that topic. Joan Allaire's book is called How We Decide. Zachary Shore's Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this, the kinds of decisions you struggle with, what it is you think goes on when you're making particular choices. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us your thoughts and questions at forum@kqed.org. Joan Allaire, I want to go back to something you said earlier in the program and that you write about in your book, which seems counterintuitive, and maybe those aren't even the right words, but that it's the more complex decisions that need emotion, and that part of the trick in making decisions is knowing sort of when to apply reason and when to apply emotion. And one of the examples you cite in your book is the story of a Navy commander who has to make a decision about whether or not to shoot down a missile because he's not sure whether it's a missile. It might actually be the aircraft, a U.S. aircraft. Walk us through that particular scene and how it is that there is this interplay between reason and emotion that helps inform, in the end, this individual making the right call.
Well, this is the second day of the ground invasion of the first Persian Gulf War in 1991. And this is a British destroyer who's in charge of protecting the Allied fleet in the Persian Gulf. And the Marines have just launched a fake attack, a feint attack, on an Iraqi naval base. And so the Iraqis, in a last-ditch, desperate gamble, decide to launch some missiles at this Allied convoy of ships in the Persian Gulf. So this British naval commander, this British naval officer who's overseeing the radar, sees this blip on his radar screen. And at first glance, he assumes he doesn't know what to assume. He feels this sharp stab of fear as soon as he sees this blip. It's 5 in the morning. He's immediately terrified, although he knows he also can't justify his terror. It's just a blip. A-6 fighter jets, which are returning from their convoys over Iraq, from their bombing sorties, fly the exact same route. So at first glance, this looks just like an A-6 fighter jet. That's the sort of thing that some other people assume it is. And yet he's seized with this very powerful emotion of fear. And the question is, why and what should he do? He's got 60 seconds to make up his mind, either shoot down this blip and hope it's a missile, or the alternative is to shoot it down and perhaps, you know, kill an Allied fighter pilot. So it's an incredibly agonizing and difficult decision. He eventually decides within those 60 seconds to shoot it down. It turns out it is a missile that was launched by the Iraqis. And what I tried to do in the book is show how his brain was able to do that. And this gets back to dopamine neurons and prediction error signals. And I think you can really understand this decision in terms of the peculiar habits of this one type of neuron and neurotransmitter we have in our brain.
And part of the point, though, also is that the commander really didn't know why he made the decision. This was not a decision based on reason alone. It wasn't like he sort of calculated it. In the end, he just sort of said, you know, I don't have a good feeling about this.
Absolutely. And investigators went back after the fact and looked at the radar tapes and found that from the perspective of, you know, a rational observer, there was no good reason to launch a missile, that it seemed like a risky gamble. And it wasn't until a cognitive psychologist named Gary Klein got involved that he showed that actually there was a way to differentiate between the radar signal of this missile and a jet. And what this naval commander did unconsciously was actually evaluate the altitude. That because the missile was flying 1,000 feet lower than a typical fighter jet, it appeared on the radar a little bit faster. And it was that very subtle difference that allowed his brain to differentiate between these two things. And that's what made him so scared. So even though he couldn't articulate the reasons behind his fear, he was able to trust this very powerful negative emotion.
And does that mean it's important sometimes to know what to tune into?
Absolutely. I end the book by talking with a world-class poker player who's also a theoretical physicist named Michael Benger at Stanford. I think he's now ranked number 3 in the world. And one of the things I found fascinating about him was here's this incredibly quantitative mind. You know, he can count cards with ease. He can do complex statistical equations in his head. And yet what's made him a great poker player is his ability to kind of know when the numbers aren't enough, to know when not to just do the math in his head and know when to trust a sweaty palm, know when to trust these very subtle visceral emotions. And one fascinating thing about Binger's technique, Binger's poker habits, is, as he put it, it's the very hard decisions. That's when he trusts his sweaty palm. You know, the relatively easy calls, the good hands or the bad hands, those you just do the probabilities in your head and, you know what to do. But it's the very complex, ambiguous hands. That's where you really have to trust your emotions.
John O'Lair, his book, How We Decide. To our calls, Bob in Fremont joins us first. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. You know, one thing I was kind of curious about is whether you call it your mind's eye or whatever. Has either author ever given any consideration that there's just some people that have a gift and ability to make these gut-wrenching decisions at a split second, and they'd be right 100% or almost 100% of the time. I doubt seriously that this is Mr. Sullenberger's first split-second ace in the hole. I'm sure that he's done this more than once. And I know a lot of people that, you know, they can't tell you what's behind door number two with any kind of reasonable certainty because it doesn't matter. But on the things that matter, they're dead on almost every single time. And whether or not we should use this as a screening tool for people who are going to be using these split-second decisions, like law enforcement, you know, military commanders and stuff like that. If law enforcement, if the officer has this innate ability when it comes down to fight or flight, when it comes down to draw your weapon and shoot and do it instinctively because you know what's going to happen in your mind's eye, or whether or not you make a blunder and it being something that costs somebody their life.
Yeah, Bob, thank you. Interesting. Let's hear from both your perspectives on this, because this is something that plays out both in the sort of immediate decisions that Bob was just talking about, whether or not to draw a weapon. We saw, of course, the tragic incident here at a BART stop just a few weeks ago that gets into these sorts of questions too. But I suppose also, Zachary Shore, it applies to sort of bigger decisions about how you avoid really big blunders that have to do with consequences that might affect, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. In your book, what do we learn from blunders that we can help us avoid making those big blunders in the future?
What we've talked about a lot so far is how emotions affect our decisions, and that's absolutely true. We see it all the time in history. What I find really hopeful is that there are many times when you don't have to make the rapid decision in a split second, when you're trying to decide policy, like whether we should invade Iraq or whether we should make some other move into a country or about our financial crisis. When you have more time to think about it, you can have your reason be elevated over your emotions. Yes, you'll be guided by your emotions, and you should be. That's right. But take, for example, this case in ancient Greece. You would think, well, that couldn't possibly apply to us. But very similar kinds of situations. We have a case from the Thucydides, the Peloponnesian War, nearly 2.5 millennia ago, where ships were dispatched to put down a rebel state that had risen against Athens. And they decided to kill all the men in the city and enslave all the women and children. And then some people in Athens said, wait a minute, maybe this is a blunder. Maybe this is not going to be in our best interest. Maybe it's too harsh. And so they actually had a reasoned debate. And one guy, Cleon, stood up and said, no, we have to put them all down, kill them all. And another guy, Diodotus, stood up and said, you know what? We're thinking about these people in rigid categories, and we're seeing them all as the same. But not all these rebels are the same. And some of them might actually, and we in fact know they do, want Athenian rule. And so let's change that decision. And they voted on it, and they actually overcame that. Now, obviously, it doesn't always happen in democracies. Sometimes we make bad decisions, and in the group we get whipped up into hysteria. But it's really hopeful that there are many cases when we can overcome those emotions and avoid blunders.
But part of your point, I think, General Lehr, is that we shouldn't necessarily overcome emotions. We shouldn't presume that reason is necessarily the ascendant force that we pay attention to.
Yeah, I think that's been the mistake of people like Plato. It's been the mistake of modern economics and even cognitive science for a long time, is this assumption that rationality is always best. And when you look at the brain, you realize that the rational brain is actually a pretty feeble part of cortex, and that the unconscious is the personal supercomputer inside your head. And it generates emotions as kind of its signal, telling us what to do, telling us is kind of a readout of all this information that's just digested. So I think it's not always the case from the perspective of your brain that it's best to be rational. I think it really depends on the kind of decision you're making.
I think, and forgive me if I've gotten your books mixed up, but I think it's in your book, Jonah Lehr, where you say something very similar to what Zachary Shore was just saying. And the example you cite is of a former GM chairman, back when GM was actually doing well, who, having heard no disagreement in a particular meeting, says what?
He tells people the meeting's been adjourned and we'll have this meeting again when someone's come up with a reason to disagree with me. And I think that gets back to what we were talking about Lincoln and Obama, that, you know, the sheer importance of having dissent, of being forced to confront conflicting points of view.
And that's something you would really second, isn't it, Zachary Shore, that invitation to dissent is going to be key, particularly in the moment we're in right now historically?
Absolutely. And if you're forced to consider differing points of view, then you are going to need to activate your rational part of the brain. emotions absolutely should affect our decisions. They do. They should. But we have to find that balance. And what often happens is that people go one extreme or the other.
Steve in Berkeley has our next query. Steve, go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call. There's an interesting debate that's actually been happening over the last couple of minutes about this tension between rationalizing decisions and the emotions, that I'm wondering if it's related to a question that I don't know if there's any research about, and that is, if we give people more time to make decisions, they will gather more information, but as both authors recognize, there's a problem of this confirmation bias, the MSNBC versus the Fox News and so on, so that with more time, I may be able to rationalize these predetermined decisions rather than really investigate new ideas. And with less time, I may not be able to do that. So my question is there any research that suggests whether with more time people make better or worse decisions?
Steve, thank you. Zachary first.
It's not entirely a function of time. It's a function of the cognizance of your cognition traps. Are you aware of these kinds of biases? If you can make yourself more aware of them, then whether in a short or long time span, you're more likely to avoid them.
But if you have a rigid ideology, almost by definition, you're not going to be aware that you have a rigid ideology, are
that's,
you?
That's, well, no, that's not actually true. In fact, there are people who can become aware, so a greater degree of self-awareness. I think one of the things about Barack Obama that we're hopeful for is that he's more self-aware than, say, other presidents we've had.
But isn't that in part because he doesn't seem quite as ideological?
Yes, I think that's true. Less ideological and a deeper thinker.
Yeah. What about that from your point of view, Jonah? More time makes for better decisions or not?
I think, again, it depends. I think one of the interesting findings of science, and this is one of the findings that I think really began to shift the way scientists thought about the benefits of rationality, came from the work of Antonio Damasio, who in the mid-1980s began studying patients who, because of a traumatic brain injury, be it a tumor or car accident, lost the ability to experience emotion. So they didn't feel fear or pleasure. And you think, if you were Plato, that these people would be uber rational, that they'd make perfectly rational decisions and would be model human beings. But instead what happened was that these people became pathologically indecisive. They would spend 5 hours choosing between a blue or black pen. They would spend all day trying to figure out where to eat lunch. So it's not simply a matter of having more time or less time or always trying to be rational. I think it's really learning how to fuse and balance these two very different ways of thinking.
Steve, thanks for the call. Interesting question. Gary is next. Gary, go ahead.
Some people can admit non-critical mistakes with no inner turmoil, and they can readily admit them. Other people would rather eat worms or lose an eye than admit a non-critical, having missed not even a non-critical mistake. How do those two different approaches work out in the long term as far as the ability to, or working toward the ability to make good decisions?
Zachary Shore.
The ability to admit one's mistakes is essential, right? We have examples of statesmen, say Eisenhower, when he was trying to decide whether to move into Southeast Asia, whether to send troops to support the French, for example. Everyone in his cabinet said, including Vice President Nixon, said, we have to go in. We have to stop the communists. Eisenhower would have been inclined to do this, but he stepped back from it and said, you know what? We're making a mistake here, and I've made mistakes before, and I'm not going to do this again because if we do this, they will see us as a replacement of the French, another colonial imperial power. And so we're not going to do that. When people are able to recognize their mistakes, yes, it takes a lot of courage and a lot of inner qualities, the empathy, the imagination to think beyond what you're being told. That's one quality. I want to add one other point, Dave, if that's okay. If we look at what helps people to overcome blunders and make better decisions, one of the things that statesmen have found, or that I find about statesmen, is that they rejected the policy options they were presented with. So usually people come and say, here are our choices. A is bad, B is worse. So C is really our most reasonable option. The wise statesman says, you know, I don't like A, B, or C. And he comes up with D or E, some creative, imaginative solution. And I think if this new administration wants to avoid blunders and make wiser decisions, that's one of the things that they need to do, challenge the assumptions that are presented to them and come up with more creative, original solutions.
Zachary Shore, again, his book, Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. Joan O'Leary, a beat more on this question of learning from mistakes and admitting mistakes, as our caller suggested was important and Zachary seconded. You also write in your book really about that it's important to have the opportunity to make mistakes, which is the flight simulator question, right? We have to have the opportunity to sort of practice and learn from our mistakes. And I'm wondering if there are ways in which you could have other simulators in life besides just flight simulators, right? Because how else can you get better at this?
Well, I talk about a variety of real world decision makers, from a soap opera director to a quarterback in the NFL. And one thing these experts, these world-class experts all had in common was this obsession with their own mistakes. And sometimes it was unpleasant. I talked to the soap opera director who, after a long day's work, the first thing he did was he would go home, put in the rough tape of that day's work, and make a list of at least 30 things he got wrong. These were mistakes so small no one else noticed them. But that was how he improved himself. And I think you can understand this from the perspective of your brain. That's how your brain cells learn best. Your brain cells generate what's called the prediction error signal. And that's a fancy way of saying they learn best when studying their own mistakes. And so by calling attention to your mistakes, whether it's in a flight simulator or just reviewing your day's work, I talked to a backgammon player who's one of the world's greatest backgammon players, who did the same thing with his backgammon games. So simply forcing yourself to look at what you just did and look at the things you got wrong, not just celebrating your successes, but forcing yourself to study what you got wrong, that's a key component of learning.
And would you say that too in policy and historical terms, Zachary Shore, that that's something policymakers ought to do at the end of each day, is sort of think, all right, these are the mistakes that I made today?
There's no question, and it's so rare that it happens. But in military history, here's an interesting case. After the German army was so successful in its first campaign against the French in World War II, it went back and it reassessed with tremendous criticism of what it had done, even though it was successful. And it went back, made a list of all the things it could have done better, and then started reinforcing them. So yes, it's in all realms, that kind of willingness to say, even when I succeed, I'm going to figure out what I need to do better. That's helpful.
Diane writes in, do your guests have suggestions for ways to access the less emotional side of the brain for decision-making while under stress? Exercises, breathing, whatever. I suspect you might say, Joan O'Leary, you don't necessarily want to access the less emotional side of your brain.
Well, I think what you want to do is figure out if your emotions are helpful. So obviously when Captain Sullenberger was flying over the Hudson, he made the quick decision that this fear he was feeling wasn't helpful, and that it was time to really think through his fear and not let his fear turn into panic. And I think that's what allowed him to realize that he shouldn't listen to the air traffic controllers who were telling him to fly to New Jersey, and that he had to make his own decision. So I think the first step is to realize if your emotions are helpful. And if not, I think then it's a matter of practice. Studies show that you can bulk up the prefrontal cortex. You can train it to be better at kind of thinking through these emotions that aren't useful. So in that sense, it's a matter of training and practice. Willpower is a bit like a muscle. Scientists will often use the metaphor of a tired muscle when it comes to things like willpower or exercising reason. And of course, the thing about a muscle is you can bulk it up. You can make it stronger. So it's just a matter of putting in the practice.
Which would tend to suggest, Zachary Shore, that experience matters. And yet, as I believe it was Nick Kristof in the New York Times wrote before the last election, if we wanted to elect the most experienced person possible to be the next president of the United States, it would be Dick Cheney. So how do you evaluate practice and experience?
It's very simple. Wisdom does not necessarily come from experience. Experience helps. It contributes. It can. But wisdom more often comes from sound judgment and the ability to rise above these cognition traps, these rigid ways of approaching and solving problems. So all the things we've been discussing and the things Jonah just said about your emotions versus your reason, yes, he's right. You have to find a balance and decide in that context, is it actually helping you? But the other thing that's really helpful in making better decisions is cultivating empathy, which is not an easy thing to do, and some people naturally have more of it than others. But it's something that I believe we can cultivate. When we look at the people who make better judgments in history, we find that the ones who had a better ability to think about what was happening on the other side, either the other person they were dealing with or another business competitor or another country, those people had much better, wiser decisions.
This is sort of wildly speculative, but let me throw it out anyway, Joan O'Leary. Much has been made during the past presidential campaign that our new president is cool, you know, that he is no drama Obama. Bit sort of like what we used to say about Joe Montana, the quarterback of the 49ers, Joe Cool. Does that worry you at all as someone who thinks that emotion plays an important role?
It doesn't worry me. I mean, it's obviously tough to speculate on what's going inside Obama's head from afar or via cable news. But it doesn't worry me precisely because I think Obama, based on these reports, does demonstrate what scientists call metacognition, which is he is very introspective. He thinks about how he's thinking. One of the things that struck me from one of the post reports of the campaign was it was an anecdote involving Obama during one of the debate rehearsals. And Obama realized that he was very upset, that he was in a bad mood and very angry. So he sent all his aides away for half an hour, did whatever he did, took a deep breath, went on the treadmill, and came back and said, "Now I'm ready. Now I can do it." So that to me demonstrated incredible emotional intelligence. You know, realizing you were filled with this negative emotion that was going to hinder whatever you're trying to do, take a deep breath and then do it. So it's stories like that. And obviously these are just secondhand stories. But stories like that give me a little bit of confidence.
Back to our call, Zachary in San Francisco. Go ahead, Zachary.
Hi, it's a fascinating discussion. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm a Zen Buddhist, and I mean the first thing you learn when you're studying Zen Buddhism practically are that categories are empty and that they don't really amount to as much as you originally thought they did, and that the key is kind of, you know, over and over again practicing self-study and paying attention to what's going on right now, and also the assertion and discovery over time that those practices, not believing categories, and a tireless self-study sort of build empathy and compassion. I just wanted to ask the guest whether there's been any work done on things like meditative techniques and whether they affect exactly these abilities that we're talking about here.
Zachary, thanks. Jonah, Lair first, and then a related question from an emailer I want to pose to Zachary. But Jonah, go ahead.
Yeah. There actually has been a lot of research done on Buddhist monks, especially by researchers at University of Wisconsin. And they have found that these are skills that, through practice, really profoundly change your brain. For example, Buddhist monks show far less amygdala activity when they are exposed to fearful stimuli. So that suggests that they've actually trained their brain to have this kind of equilibrium, so it doesn't get panicked when it hears a car backfire. So there's some clear evidence that this actually does have profound effects and really does change the wiring of your brain.
And the related question I want to pose to you, Zachary Shore, is Matthew, who writes in, how do religious biases or beliefs function within the effects we are discussing? Do these biases have a more profound effect than other types of biases? And I guess this gets us back to the point you write about, which is the mirror imaging problem, that we may not always be aware of how we see ourselves, or rather we make the assumption that other people will function just the way we do. And you tell an interesting story in your book about, I believe it was in Afghanistan, where we make a mistake about assuming how villagers are going to behave because that's how we'd behave.
That's right. I look at Haider Akbar, a teenage Afghan-American who went to visit his father, who became the governor of Kunar province in Afghanistan. And he observed and worked with U.S. military officers there. He worked as a translator, and he saw some of the things that they were doing, interacting with local Afghans. What he saw was that the soldiers were projecting their own expectations onto the villagers. And when they got into disputes, they couldn't break free of that mindset. It was like a dogma. They simply didn't understand that the Afghans had a distinct history which involved dealing with communists. In one case, there was a guy who had a record with all of the villagers of abusing them, of using his former power under the communist regime against them. And now he comes in and he's asked to work with the other Afghans who were not former communists. The American soldiers didn't understand what was going on there, and they looked at a traffic violation, for example, of speeding ticket as being something that had no background to it. They didn't understand all the background to it. They just took it from their own perspective. And so once Haider Akbar, this Afghan-American kid, could look into the situation and understand what they were really going through in the village and all their history and background, then he was able to break free of that mirror imaging cognition trap.
Just have a moment or so less. And so I'm just going to ask you as a last quick thought, Joan Allaire and then Zachary Shore, on as we enter this new and complex and fascinating time, how should we begin to evaluate our own decision making, and what hopes, I guess, would you have, Joan Allaire, for how the new president makes his decisions in this extraordinarily complicated time?
Then the first step is to become aware of these hardwired flaws we all have built into our brain, things like loss aversion, things that can't help but affect the way we make decisions. And the only way to avoid making these consistent set of mistakes is to become aware of them. And that's where thinking about thinking becomes so important. That's where metacognition is such a crucial skill, being able to become aware of these mistakes and then in your daily life not make these mistakes.
And briefly, Zachary Shore, pay attention to history.
I agree. What I also want to do is keep that awareness of cognition traps. That's why I list them all in the table of contents to say, let's focus on these, and if we're just conscious of them, we'll make wiser decisions.
Zachary Shore, his book is called Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. Joan Allaire joined us as well. His book is called How We Decide. Thanks both very much for being part of our program today. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.